Back in 1999, there was a tragic shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Two angry young students, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, shot and killed 12 students and one teacher and wounded 23 others. Now, here's the question. What, if anything, does this tragedy, this hideous mass shooting that occurred all those years ago in Colorado, what does that have to do with the current evangelical vote for and continued support for Donald Trump coming out of the 2016 election and in some cases getting stronger even today? After looking into this story, I think there's a connection. I think we can provide a bit of an explanation as to how these two events are related. Now, I have to tell you, this is going to take me a few minutes to tell this story, but trust me, it's going to be worth it in the end as I try to establish the connections between then and now. When we begin to examine the narrative or the storyline that came out of that Columbine shooting, in the immediate aftermath and then the months and years following the Columbine shooting, what came out of that tragic incident was a martyrdom narrative. And this narrative was essentially based on the story of one student in particular who was tragically murdered, Cassie Bernal. And what Cassie's murder did was that it provided the evangelical Christians in America with a way to kind of enshrine or turn Cassie Bernal into a martyr based upon her Christian faith. We heard a version that is just an unbelievable story. She was immortalized as the girl who said yes. The basic story went like this. Eric Harris, one of the shooters, asked Cassie Bernal if she believed in God as he pointed a shotgun into her face. She said yes, and he then shot her, murdered her in cold blood. And this martyrdom narrative quickly sprang up within really hours after the whole shooting was over. That martyrdom narrative of Cassie Bernal standing up for her faith and being killed spurred sort of a cottage industry of its own. There were a lot of songs that came out of that. For example, Michael W. Smith wrote a song called This Is Your Time, and that song won the Dove Awards that year in 1999. There was another song done by Christian rock metal band Flyleaf called Cassie, and it was obviously based on the story of Cassie Bernal being martyred for her faith. In fact, here's some of the lyrics from that song, Cassie, by Flyleaf. All heads are bowed in silence to remember her last sentence. She answered him, that is the shooter, knowing what would happen, her last words hanging in the air. This martyrdom legend wasn't simply confined to the CCM industry either. In fact, just 1 year after the tragedy in Columbine, Cassie's own mother, Misty Bernal, would go on to write a book about her daughter's experience and martyrdom, and it was entitled She Said Yes, The Unlikely Martyrdom of Cassie Bernal. That book quickly went on to become a bestseller. In the book, Misty described her daughter's conversion to Christianity, her struggles with her faith, and ultimately her death as a martyr because, of course, she had taken a stand for God. Now, in the months and years that followed, that story spun out into an unbelievable rallying cry for Christian youth all over America in the 1990s and into the 2000s. For example, a giant youth conference was held in Pontiac, Michigan, in which 73,000 teenagers wept after hearing stories about the death of Cassie Bernal and how she was such a martyr. And as the rally ended, thousands came forward to accept Christ. And this story has gone on to have legendary status among evangelicals even to this day. Stories like that of Cassie's kind of have morphed into a martyrdom or persecution complex that kind of goes along this line. Not only are you going to be persecuted for your faith if you are an evangelical Christian, there was already that storyline well before the Columbine shooting, but evangelicals point to what happened to Cassie Bernal and others of her classmates that allegedly stood up for the faith and were shot as heroes and martyrs. And it was this idea that Christians have not only historically been persecuted for their faith, but that it's going to get worse and worse as time goes on. And even today, Christians are still pointing to people like Cassie Bernal as a shining example of what it means to be a sold-out Christian for God. She refused to deny God, and she became a martyr because of it. And that legend has spun out, as I said, in songs and books and sermons and movies. And what it's done in mainstream American culture is it's fed into this myth, this narrative that Christians in general are going to be persecuted, certainly looking at the end times, eschatology, the end of the world type narrative, the tribulation and all that, what's going to lead up to that. But also, they were persecuted during the Obama administration. And now I think we can start making that connection between why so many evangelical Christians voted for Donald Trump in 2016, that 81% white evangelical base. And this is something that I'm going to be talking about in a few minutes with my special guest this week for this bonus episode, filmmaker Christopher Maloney. Now, Chris has come out with a film this last year called In God We Trump, and it explores the connection between the evangelical support and vote for Trump, and even the continued ongoing support now 2 years into his presidency. What's it all about? And I think one of the narratives, one of the storylines, as I say, goes back to a person like Cassie Bernal. In fact, even in 2016, during the American presidential race, candidate Rick Santorum brought this myth up. And what he was doing was he was actually defending Kim Davis. Who is Kim Davis? She was a Kentucky county clerk who was jailed for refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. And what Santorum did in defending Kim Davis was to dredge up this old myth of Cassie Bernal as an example of, look, how far America has slid morally. 16 years ago, he said, we had this poor young woman who was shot and killed for refusing to back down in the face of incredible danger about her faith in God. And look how far we've come. Now, a person who makes a stand against a gay couple refusing to issue them a marriage license is similarly a martyr. And America is going down the tubes. Christians are being persecuted, and we're just going to be persecuted all the more. That's why so many people, I believe, ended up voting for Donald Trump, at least that 81% white evangelical base. But that's just one narrative. But it shows you how evangelicals can use something, even though it's been now debunked. Guess what? That story about Cassie Bernal and how she was a martyr for saying yes to the question, do you believe in God? Turns out that narrative isn't true at all. Yes, Cassie Bernal was tragically murdered, but what we know more of the story. The eyewitness accounts of other students who were there at the time and saw the whole thing, yes, she was tragically murdered, but this martyrdom myth was actually built on false evidence. And you can find out more about this story in The New Republic, or there's an article on this on Vox as well. But you know what? It will not make any difference. It doesn't matter how much evidence you can present to evangelicals that debunks the narrative of what happened to Cassie. It doesn't matter. In their minds, she is a martyr. She will forever be a martyr who was tragically killed for standing up for her faith. For example, listen to what the Bernal's pastor had to say about this after some more facts came out that basically debunked the whole martyrdom narrative of what happened to Cassie. This is what Pastor Dave McPherson, who was the Bernal's pastor at the time of the shooting, this is what he had to say about it. He said, quote, the church is going to stick to the martyr story. That's the Cassie Bernal story. It's the story they heard first, he said, and circulated for 6 months uncontested. You can say that it didn't happen that way, but the church won't accept it. To the church, he concludes, Cassie will always say yes, period, end quote. And this, again, as I say, has spun out into a larger narrative of evangelical Christians being persecuted and maybe even martyred for their faith, for standing up for God. And that myth or that narrative has become deeply embedded in the evangelical, certainly the white evangelical culture of America. And this is something that helps to explain, as I say, not only the vote for Trump, but the continued ongoing support for him by evangelicals in America. The truth is that evangelicals are not being persecuted in America today. But it doesn't matter. As I say, no matter how much evidence is provided to the contrary, the legends of martyrs like Cassie Bernal have just long fed into that myth that American Christians are not only being persecuted, they needed to elect a president who would guarantee to preserve their religious liberties. Okay, I apologize for the long introduction, but I wanted to provide you some of the background, the historical context that sort of explains a little bit about what's going on in American evangelicalism, and hopefully you'll find out even more in my conversation right now that we're going to get into with filmmaker Christopher Maloney as we discuss In God We Trump. I am really excited to be talking to my guest this week. I've got Chris Maloney, who is a filmmaker. He came out this year with a movie. I think it's out on Amazon as well as on iTunes. Chris, you came out with a movie called In God We Trump, and I'm really interested to talk about that because I follow this story with great interest. Why did that 81% white evangelical base not only vote for Donald Trump, but even now, 2 years into his presidency, continue to support him? So I know we're going to get into that and more. So thanks for being on the show, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what was it that led you to do this film in the first place? What was your interest in exploring this connection between the Trump vote and evangelicals?
Well, I was raised evangelical. So I grew up very much in the church in the Midwest. So I know that world pretty well, or at least I thought I did.
Yeah, we thought we did.
With the growing support starting back in, I guess, 2015, when Trump first announced that he was going to run for president, and then he kept on going and he got the nomination. The thing that was kind of the most shocking to me about the whole thing was how these people that I grew up with and thought I knew got behind him so readily. And so I had been just kind of really perplexed by that and upset by it. And then when he won the election and it came out that he had gotten 81% of the evangelical Christian vote, that's when I realized, I guess I don't know this world very well after all. And I started going down this rabbit hole of just trying to figure out for myself how this happened, how this relationship happened, and how it led to him actually becoming president. And the result of all that and the result of the people I talked to took the form of a film, and that's how this whole thing got started.
And I looked at some of the reviews that you had on Amazon, just for example, and there was a wide range. People saying, some guy said, I'd rather have 1,000 paper cuts to my eye than watch this film again. So obviously he's a Trump fan. He thinks your film is absolute rubbish. But then there's other people that are saying, no, thank you so much for doing this work, because it is shining the light on this connection between, as you say, the Trump and the evangelical base that not only voted for him, they continue in large number to continue to support him, don't they? His base hasn't really gone away.
No. Yeah. A lot of evangelicals are very, very happy with him.
They think he's God's man.
It's gotten to the point where I don't think that there's anything he can do. Literally, I don't think there's anything he could do to make him lose his base. And that's because, for one thing, being Christian, for the people who voted for him because of their Christian faith, voting for him, I think, is so closely connected with their Christian faith that the idea of questioning him or questioning their support of him in some strange way would be equivalent to, like, questioning their faith itself or questioning God. So it's gotten to the point where they will follow him wherever he goes.
No matter what he does, no matter what he says, it's true. There's that sense of, I guess, cognitive dissonance. The way I see it is they are suppressing the more troubling aspects of his presidency, just as they suppressed the really troubling things about his candidacy. Certainly the Access Hollywood tape and the multiple affairs. I mean, he was known for being a playboy. None of this was a secret. It's just that more things have come out in the last few years. And yet people like James Dobson will say, hey, well, he's a Christian now. And, you know, that was in his past. And so there's all these elaborate justifications as to why it's okay that he's done what he's done and continues to do what he's doing. A lot of it, I think, has to do with protecting their religious freedoms. Is that what you found? What was the kind of main connection between why they voted for him? Was it that religious freedom, the feeling like they were being persecuted by the Obama era?
That's part of it. There was a lot of anger that had built up during the Obama presidency from the religious right, because they had basically 8 years where they were just, they had so little influence, and they had to stomach 8 years of a guy that they really did not like. And I think that they were able to, even though they're white evangelical Christians and they come with this inherent white privilege, there's this narrative going on in the Christian church here in America that somehow Christians are persecuted, and that an Obama presidency played into that because of things like Obama being okay with same-sex marriage or with being a pro-choice candidate. Those things play into that narrative. So they, I think, used all this anger, and that was part of what fueled them to vote for someone who is the exact opposite of Barack Obama. So anger was part of it. The religious freedoms is some of it too. There was there's a piece we talk about in the film where Trump got rid of the Johnson Amendment, which is basically something that Lyndon Johnson had put into effect that pretty clearly separates churches and states when it comes to like voicing opinions from the pulpit, for example, or endorsing political candidates from the pulpit. Trump signed something that basically went against that. So that means that preachers and pastors have now even more freedom to blur those lines between church and state. Like a preacher can go up in front of his congregation and say, you should vote for Donald Trump, and here's why. And there's no retribution for that officially.
No consequences.
So yeah, that was something that they're really happy about and that they wanted. Yeah, I mean, those things, among other things, were why they got in bed with him and why they continue to stick with him.
And of course, we know that appointing conservative judges to the Supreme Court is making them really happy. For a lot of Christians or evangelicals, abortion is the big plank in their platform, isn't it? Homosexuality and abortion are the two big items. And if they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade, they're thinking, happy days. This is, we're going to have a majority of Supreme Court justices. So you see the Kavanaugh thing that gets ramrodded through, and evangelicals were so happy that he made it onto the Supreme Court. If they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade, so that's another element to this whole story, isn't it? It must be.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. The abortion and same-sex marriage are, they can't be overstated when it comes to how evangelicals vote. So the Kavanaugh thing, yeah, a lot of evangelicals are really happy with the whole idea of overturning Roe versus Wade. It's become, I think, such an obsession with the religious right that the ends justify the means. So if they can get some conservative judges appointed, they don't care how they get there. They don't care how immoral the president is who appoints them, or that he doesn't, he says he's a Christian, but he doesn't go to church or anything. As long as they're getting the judges that they want, they've got a real blind spot to almost everything else, which is pretty disappointing. And as far as like being anti-abortion, I mean, that's their right to feel that way and have that opinion. But if they are, then they should have been happy with a president like Barack Obama, because the abortion rate went down, because his presidency is in favor of, you know, providing birth control to employees and providing sex education that encourages safe sex, which leads to fewer unwanted pregnancies, which in turn leads to fewer abortions. So it's very hypocritical and very self-defeating to get behind a Republican candidate just for the purpose of abortion. And it's kind of a house of cards thing. If you pull one, it all kind of topples over, which really doesn't make sense in the long run.
But of course, we know historically, for example, the Catholic Church, they're against handing out condoms because they say, right, we don't want to encourage people to have sex outside of marriage,
yep,
period. So that's probably why they wouldn't have supported Obama, because they're saying, well, the abortion rate has gone down, but he has no problem with people having sex outside of marriage. So that goes against their purity culture teachings as well. So you can understand, I guess, from their point of view, they want to stop abortions, full stop.
Yeah, but it's not effective, though.
Exactly. It's not working. Well, and I wanted to go back to what you said earlier. You were saying you were shocked, I guess, by when all this was coming out, the candidacy and then the election of Trump. Is it something, though, that's a new thing? Because from what I've read and researched and written about it myself, this goes back to the religious right guys, the moral majority, guys like Jerry Falwell, back in the days of Ronald Reagan even, and maybe before that, the National Association of Evangelicals. When evangelicalism became a thing in America after World War II, I think it really when it kind of surged, and then they got involved in the political sphere. So they've been involved in the political sector for decades now. As my way of understanding it, this is just the consequence of decades of involvement by the religious right in politics.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that was something that I didn't understand when I first, and that's why I guess I was surprised, because I didn't understand just how nakedly ambitious evangelicals had been in trying to get influence in the political sphere to the point where they would give character a pass. That part is still amazing to me. I guess it's not surprising at this point anymore, but it does still amaze me. I guess like what I discovered is that the religious right and the moral majority, people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, they kind of really formed a connection with the presidency starting with Ronald Reagan. And they had been trying to get influence up until that point because of how the culture was kind of shifting in the 60s and 70s with the idea of like free love and even things like recreational marijuana use and having sexual relationships outside of marriage were becoming more normal. Same-sex relationships were becoming more accepted. These were all things that made the religious right extremely uncomfortable. So their idea of combating it was to start trying to gain more influence in national politics as a way to like squash these things down and make them go away. So that had already started, but then when Ronald Reagan came around, he was already being criticized by the religious right to an extent because he had been divorced before and because he was from he was seen as like a Hollywood guy because he used to be an actor, and he was seen as almost like an elite because he was from California. So he had those things going against him, but Jerry Falwell reached out to him and they basically made this agreement. Like, I think Jerry Falwell basically said in so many words, I can deliver the conservative Christian vote to you if you help us out in turn.
Exactly. Like, make a deal.
Let's connect with each other. Let's help each other out. And it worked. And so from that point on, Reagan was suddenly more, you know, claimed to be a religious guy and claimed to be a man of God because he knew that he had to in order to keep the votes that Falwell had kind of delivered in up to him.
Exactly.
So that was where it started. The disappointing thing is that it's just gotten more and more ridiculous to the point where someone like Trump comes along, and as long as he's anti-abortion and so forth, his character seems to have no bearing on whether or not they'll support him or not. They'll just support him.
Blindly support him. Well, going back to what you said about Jerry Falwell, from what I understand, the reason abortion was such a hot topic was that before that, the evangelicals really weren't all that concerned. It wasn't really on their radar. But Falwell realized that this was something that he could use to unite both the evangelicals and the Catholics together. And like you say, deliver a even bigger voting block to the Republican Party. And so that was kind of the first time you see abortion becoming a thing in evangelicalism. Guys like Falwell are able to make political capital out of it to deliver votes, as you say, for their chosen candidate, who in turn is expected to deliver for them on the legislation that they want. And so it's a win-win from their point of view. So then that's been going on, as you say. Now it's the culmination of some of the worst of the presidential candidates we've ever seen from a moral point of view. I mean, these are the same people that were screaming about Bill Clinton having an affair in the White House,
yeah,
about the importance of integrity and character and leadership. And, you know, in our public figures, it's so important. We have to have leadership and integrity. And what about all that? Trump's got none of it, and they're blindly supporting him, as you say.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For you know, thousands of years, there was no real official stance, or there was no fixation on things like abortion or even same-sex relationships. It wasn't really front and center until it became, like you said, something that could help sway political leaders. So it's a very cynical agreement that they made. And it's a bargain. It's a deal with the devil.
It is.
I've said before, I just don't, out of Trump and the religious right. I don't know which one I'm calling the devil here, but it is a deal with the devil. It's a back alley agreement when they both get something, and neither of them really have anything more than selfish ambition in mind.
I think it has a lot to do with the desire that they feel to win the culture war, because, and I think in America for sure, it goes back to the historic roots of Puritanism in America, where it was based on this covenant theology. So if our nation as a nation is on the path of righteousness, then God will bless us as a nation corporately. Whereas if we start to sin, meaning like things like abortion, homosexuality, sex outside of marriage and all this, God will actually start to judge America as a nation. And so I think that's a lot of what drives these people. I remember there's that famous footage on the 700 Club the day after 9/11. I don't know if you've seen that clip. Maybe you put it in your movie. I don't know. But where Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and they say, why did this happen? The gays, the abortionists, the liberals, atheists, it's their fault. And God is judging America. And that's the dynamic, isn't it, that you see in the political involvement on the religious right?
Yeah, it was 2 days after, on September 13th.
Oh, right. I got that mop by
Jerry Falwell came on 700 Club and said that. And yes, that definitely made it into the film.
Yeah, I used to show that to my students over here in Britain, and I'd say, let's talk about covenant theology. Here's a prime example of what this is in our modern world today. These guys are associating God's judgment of America with our sin as a nation. And so, they're going to turn a blind eye to all of Trump's moral failings because he's going to get us back on that path of righteousness somehow by overturning Roe versus Wade. And God's going to start blessing us as a country. I mean, that's the convoluted logic. Somehow it must be.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, totally.
That's the logic. So what have you found? What was the kind of the most surprising element of the interviews and the things that did make it into your movie? Anything really catch you off guard?
Oh, yeah, a lot of things. It surprised me, in addition to the evangelical stance on abortion and same-sex marriage, in addition to those things, they pretty much, toe the line on the entire conservative platform now. So that goes along with, evangelicals are very likely to be climate change deniers, for example. They're very likely to be anti-gun control. It kind of all, there's really no separation between the modern-day Republican Party and modern-day evangelical Christians. They've just become part and parcel of the same thing. For example, there's a segment in the film where we talk about how part of the reason why there's no concern about the environment, and part of the reason why Trump saying that climate change is a hoax that we don't need to be concerned with, part of the reason why that's okay with evangelicals is because they don't think it's something to be concerned with either. Because since we're, in their view, since this is their temporary home and they're on their way to heaven, there's no reason to take care of the earth around them. And in fact, if they elect somebody who doesn't care about protecting the environment and treats the environment badly, then all that does is potentially accelerate the speed at which Jesus will come back, because the earth will be destroyed and he'll have to come back, and then they'll get to go to heaven and they don't have to live with gay people or people get abortions anymore. They'll be gone.
It's a win-win for them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a good thing for them.
And let it all go.
In evangelical circles, it's just kind of the idea of climate change is just kind of a joke. It's not seen as a real thing at all. And I guess I was surprised by just how up and down the line evangelicals are with Republicans now. There's really, they've tied themselves together so closely that the fate of one equals the fate of the other. So, like, if the American church dies out, the American church as we know it just kind of fizzles out, I think that also means that the Republican Party will just kind of fizzle out. And that's that they've made their bed together. So whatever happens to one happens to the other now.
They've hitched their wagon to this guy, and that's it. Well, look at the statistics, for example. Like you said, the Republican Party, I heard this the other day, that the majority of Trump voters are white men 45 and up. And so that's an entire generation that is physically dying out, isn't it? So within 30 years, those guys will be dead, literally. And the Republican Party isn't replacing them with another up-and-coming generation. So in the church is in a kind of a similar boat, isn't it, that you look at the church growth statistics in America, most churches are flatlining or declining. What churches, when they report numerical growth, it's because of transfer growth. It's people going to a different church. So one church may be growing numerically, but it's because people left another church down the road and came to that one. So they're not really doing a good job of conversion growth. So actually, they're in a kind of a similar boat, as you say. So it's sort of like the big last roll of the dice in a way, it seems to me, when you look at it from that kind of point of view.
Yeah, I think it's a death rattle. I really do. I think it's one last gasp before it just dies out altogether. I don't know really how long that'll take, but one of the people we interviewed for the film, he's a historian from Alabama University and, or Auburn University, excuse me. And he was talking about how what's happening in America now, just looking at the numbers and looking at demographics, it's pretty much what already happened in places like Great Britain, is that just the importance of religion in general, has declined there. And the policies that are made there, by and large, don't really rely on views of God. And he said that's going to happen here. You probably in about 50 years will resemble most European nations. The only surprising thing is that it hasn't happened yet, that it's happening now and it didn't happen years and years ago. For some reason, America's kind of held on to this puritanical streak that we have. And what we're seeing now is the beginning of it kind of falling away.
That is true. I mean, I've lived over here in Great Britain for almost 13 years now. And that's one thing that was striking when we first moved here. We noticed right away that there's a huge difference between here and America in that what you just described. You don't see churches and Christians involved in the political sphere like you do in America, not even close. And you don't see it, as you say, in Europe either. They have churches there, but they're pretty empty. They're mostly museum pieces in a way because they're so old. You know, they might be 800-900 years old, which is beautiful from a historical point of view, but there's hardly anybody in them coming to, on a Sunday service. It just doesn't have the impact in daily life as it does in places like America and Canada, I guess, to some extent as well, but not in the political sphere. So that's a huge difference for sure.
Yeah, and that gives me great hope. I mean... One of the things that surprises a lot of people when they see the film or they find out about the film is that despite all this, I do could still consider myself a Christian. I just don't have anything to do with the evangelical label anymore. There's no integrity with that label any longer, and I don't see them resembling the life of Jesus in any way. So I'm able to separate the life and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth from what the evangelical church has tried to turn it into. And I rejoice at the thought of the American church dying out. I think that'll be a fantastic thing because at this point it's done more harm than good. And I think a lot of us, especially people who are deconstructing or who aren't especially interested in religion, they just don't need the corporate church anymore to aid them in their spiritual journeys.
Yeah, I've been surprised. I'm part of the Ex-Evangelical Facebook group, and there's, I don't know, about 3,000 people in there now, I guess. But I've asked this question many times on Twitter as well as in that group. How many of you left Christianity as a direct result of the Trump evangelical vote and continued support?
Yeah.
And I consistently get people answering saying, that's when I walked away. That was the last straw for me. And that was, in my case, that was the last straw. I was already deconstructing, as you say. I had already left the church years ago, but I was kind of, I still maybe had one foot in there a little bit. But I thought, you know what? That's it. I'm done. I don't want to be labeled a Christian, as you say. If that's what it means, I'm out. That's it. That's it for me. And so the church hasn't, I don't think they've come to grips at all with the damage to people like me and others who have walked away from Christianity, not just the church, but because of their vote for Trump and support for him. They got a reckoning that they're going to have to pay at some point here.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are paying for it. There's a stat that we used in the beginning of the film where we talk about how because of the church's embrace of Trump in America, the church in that year lost something like 13% of churchgoers.
Really?
Like they just lost them altogether. Yeah. Just
walked away.
Because of the election.
They were just so sickened by the whole thing, they just walked away. That was the final straw.
Right. Yeah, they just stopped going to church altogether. So that's the price that they're paying. And I think they'll continue to pay that price. Like I said recently, you know, a lot of us were already, I'm in your similar situation. I had stopped going to church a couple of years ago. And then the support of Trump just kind of closed that door for good. I don't see myself attending a church again. Now, my faith is very much a personal thing that I think going to church would actually inhibit.
It's not going to help in the short or the long run, is it? So yeah, you're saying the churches they've already paid a price just on a numeric point of view. And then as time goes on, what's the future of the evangelical church in America? You already said that you think this is kind of the death rattle. What do you see the future of the church being in 10, 15, 20 years in America?
I see it being like you said, the museum pieces, or just, you know, demolished in favor of a mini mall or something. Just the economy of it doesn't quite add up anymore. Like, just keeping money to keep buildings operational and running, if you're losing more and more people that can potentially give you tithes, that's not a long-term formula that can work, I don't think. And then also, just with my generation and younger, I'm 32, our interest in church just isn't really there, not enough to go. So I think what I really hope is that if there is any semblance of what Jesus was talking about, I mean, if that church, the church that he mentioned, exists at all, it won't exist inside a building. I think it'll exist as a small group of people in the margins who try to do good things for others. I think that's what it always should have been. It should never have been something that tried to gain power or something that tried to gain political influence. And it did successfully. And now, because of it, it's less relevant and it's falling apart.
Historically, you can see that for sure. You go back to the Roman Empire. Every time the church has crawled in bed with the state, as it were, there's been a seemingly positive gain from their point of view. They get money, they get political power and buildings and all this. But in the long run, what they lose is the credibility factor, the grassroots movement, as you say. And so they become actually the oppressor. That's a historic trend that goes back to the church and Constantine getting in bed with the Spanish conquest of the New World, and, you know, getting behind Adolf Hitler before World War II, the German evangelical church. So you can see when the church has done that, where it's led them, ultimately it's they've been far worse off in the long run historically.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's why I wish people would study history more closely. It's very easy to see, like the historian that's in the film was talking about it. If this is your job and you are an historian and you look at numbers and you look at trends, it was very easy to see that this will not pan out very well.
The end game cannot be a good thing. It's all about the short-term gains. As someone says, you know, stepping over dollars to pick up shiny pennies. It seems like, hey, they look a lot better, but it's worth a lot less in the long run. What do you make of a guy like Mike Pence? Because that's another issue too, isn't there? Because evangelicals may think, well, okay, if Trump does get impeached for whatever reason, whether it's the Mueller probe or the investigation or whatever, now that the Democrats have the House, but we've got Pence. He's definitely an evangelical. There's no question about it. Trump, probably not. But absolutely Pence, he's a fundamentalist all the way. So he could step in and take over. Are they feeling reassurance about a guy like Mike Pence?
I think Mike Pence initially helped bring around some evangelicals who were maybe still on the fence a little bit, because he is an evangelical favorite and because his views, especially about homosexuality, are so extreme. He's seen as like a more stable person, I suppose. So that kind of tempered the choice of Trump by making it seem more normal. But at the same time, I think if he ran alone, like if he were to try to get the primary in 2020, for example, I don't think he would get the evangelical support that Trump got. I don't think he's exciting enough for them.
He's pretty bland,
extreme enough.
But now I read an article the other day that said Trump, there's some rumor that he might not be using Pence in his 2020 reelection bid because he's already got that evangelical base solidified now. He doesn't need Pence anymore. And now what he wants to do is pick a woman vice president, because there's such an overwhelming majority of women that hate Trump that he needs to pick up that vote. So he might have used Pence, and now he's going to discard him, as you say, so cynical. Now, whether or not that's true in 2020, we'll have to see, but they're already talking about that now, that he cynically picked Pence, as you say, to sway that those evangelicals that were on the fence. Like, well, Trump's not the greatest guy, but he's got Mike Pence behind him, so he must be all right.
Right. Yeah. And it's sad that even though that was such an obvious pandering choice, that it worked. Some extent. You know, when John McCain picked Sarah Palin because he needed the support of women, I think that was a very transparent choice and people didn't buy it. For some reason, when Trump picked Pence, to me, it was very transparent, but it worked, unfortunately.
They bought it. And that's what I kept saying on Facebook and Twitter during the run up to the election. I kept repeating myself till my wife kept saying, you got to stop saying this because no one's listening. But I kept saying, hey, Americans, why can't you see through this guy? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And that was my view back before 2016. But that's changed now. I realize, okay, it's not about seeing through the guy. It's what you said. It's the cynicism and the pragmatism of this guy's going to get us there. And of course, they hated Hillary more because my sister said this to me once. She said, well, what did you want me to do? She's a fundamentalist Christian. Well, we didn't like Trump, but we hated Hillary worse. There's no way we're going to vote for a Democrat. So we had no choice but to vote for Trump. And I think a lot of evangelicals maybe felt like stuck between a rock and a hard place. Did you find that out when you were doing your research for the film as well?
Yeah, somewhat, which I still don't quite understand the hatred for Hillary Clinton. I've never really gotten that. I understand that she had some baggage, and I was talking with a friend of mine who's a Christian pastor, and he voted for a third party candidate because he was, you know, he thought Trump was a lunatic, but he told me, I just didn't like Hillary. And I said, all right, you didn't like her, but did you think she was qualified? I said, oh yeah, she was qualified. So what's interesting to me is that people who can admit that she was more qualified, that's less important than whether they happen to like her or not. So I did find some of that, even though, like we talk about in the film, you know, she claims to be a Christian also, and she's been like a lifelong Methodist.
Yeah,
and
she's a lifelong churchgoer.
Even when she was First Lady, she was attending this weekly Bible study that people didn't even know about till years later. So I don't know why that expression of Christianity somehow doesn't translate. But Trump saying, I'm a good Christian, even though I've never asked for forgiveness, that does translate.
You can make, as you say, a far stronger case that Hillary is a Christian way beyond anything Trump's ever done. I mean, like, you can look at the examples of when he was a candidate. Why do I need to ask for forgiveness? I've never done anything wrong. That was a classic one.
Yeah, exactly.
2 Corinthians, and it's so clear that he doesn't know anything about the Bible. He never went to church. If he did, it was just a political stunt. But Hillary, like you say, she is a lifelong churchgoer, but she's pro-abortion. And that's where my sister went. She went, hey, I'm not going to vote for someone who's pro-abortion. And Trump is pro-life, and so he's promised to help us overturn Roe versus Wade. So, of course, that became a no-brainer at that point. So the abortion thing comes up yet again.
Yeah, I get frustrated with the pro-life argument because it's really not accurate. I mean, I really have no problem with somebody being pro-life. But for me, if it ends at the birth of a child, then that's not really pro-life. It's pro-birth. Now, pro-life to me is voting for gun reform so that children don't have to be afraid when they go to school, and I don't have to be afraid when I go to the movies that I'm going to be gunned down. That's pro-life to me. Or pro-life to me is creating a policy that does not separate children from their families and shove them in cages like animals. Like, exactly. That to me is not pro-life. So the pro-life thing is wonderful. That's fine with me, as long as it's consistent and it goes through actually honoring life and not just the birth of a baby that they could give a shit about after it's born.
Exactly. Well, we see the hypocrisy, as you point out, in evangelicalism. They're really not pro-life. They're pro-fetus. Until the baby's born, they want to protect that life. But then once you're born, hey, kid, you're on your own. And they're pro-gun. They're pro-military. As you said, they have no problem with the immigration policy separating families at the border and all the rest of it. So there's a huge level of cognitive dissonance there, surely. And they're going, yeah, we're not really pro-life. Like you said, we're not really being consistent. It's only protecting that fetus. And they're making it's all or nothing. As you say, it's that whole house of cards.
Yeah. It's sort of, and even this is not empirical, just anecdotal stuff that I noticed growing up in church, is that the same people who were so rabid about being anti-abortion were the same people who, if they had kids of their own, beat them and treated them with no respect whatsoever. So it's not, like I said, it's not consistent at all. Yeah, it's a real blind spot for a lot of evangelicals, for most of them.
And again, it's a hit on the credibility factor. So they're losing people because of the Trump vote and this quote-unquote pro-life stance. So what kind of responses have you gotten from the film? I mean, you've got a guy on Amazon saying he'd rather have 1,000 paper cuts to his eyes than watch your movie again. But there's a lot of positive responses as well. What have you gotten? Has it been that wide range, that sort of gamut of rabid fundamentalists who think you're nothing more than the Antichrist for putting this film out there?
Well, I take that as a great compliment.
That's a compliment.
But yeah. It actually has been mostly positive, which I've been really encouraged by.
That's good.
There is the occasional nut, like you said, which I kind of doubt that person watched the movie. I think they find out about the premise and get offended. That's usually what I find with the things that are that silly. I've gotten a few hateful messages, but what's good about that is that, to me, it just means that people are aware of it and that it's reaching people. I knew going into it that it was going to be a controversial subject. I mean, my own parents, I'm sure, won't even watch it for that reason. Conventional wisdom says that you should not talk about
religion and politics.
Religion or politics in,
you've done
in
both.
Polite society. But to me, we're in such a crisis now that the last thing we need is to be polite. So putting the movie out there, putting my own views out there, I knew it was going to get some backlash, and it has, but mostly people have been receptive.
You're going to get some pushback. And you got to think that your classic Trumpist, your Fox News guy, your diehard Trump evangelical, either isn't going to watch the movie at all, as you say, or if they do, it's to disprove it all. You're not going to convince the diehard Trumpist, are you, to change his mind and go, you know what, Chris, you're absolutely right. The guy's horrible. And my God, that we've done tremendous damage to the church in America. We've got to change our ways. I'm going to vote Democrat the next election.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I don't think any diehard Trumpists have actually sat down and watched it.
Exactly. They're not going to.
But I doubt it would make the scales fall from their eyes, to be honest.
So who's the movie for? That's the question. Is there a target sort of audience out there that you really want to see this movie, or that should see this movie? The Trumpist is not going to watch it, so you're wasting your time there.
Yep.
Who should see this film?
Well, I think it's people like you and me. People who have previously, the church has meant something to us and it's been significant in our lives. And we've seen, we've seen the skeletons in the closet and we've seen what they really are. And to me, I mean, I want people to know what evangelicals are doing and how they are trying to successfully, in some ways, take America hostage for their own specific religious views. That to me is so dangerous. And I want people to at least be aware of it so that they can try to stop it. So for me, it's really for anyone with an open mind, and also people who also in our boat have deconstructed to some extent, and this will kind of help them see this is what the church is now, and you were right to abandon it.
You've done the right thing. It doesn't matter, even if you were raised in a completely non-religious home or environment, you have been impacted by religion, in certainly in American society, as you say, because of the church's involvement in the political sphere. Because they've influenced legislation and they're influencing the current administration. So it is affecting people. I mean, look, for example, at Trump's trying to erase basically transgender as a category. You know,
right.
There's only male and female, and that has got to be right out of the evangelical playbook. So if he can do that, they're going to be ecstatic. If he can overturn Roe versus Wade, they'll be ecstatic. We're winning the culture war. That's going to affect millions of lives. Even though they're totally non-religious, they're being affected by religion. So yeah, it's a kind of a warning thing, isn't it? People need to know what's happening here.
Yeah, I saw it as my patriotic duty to make the film, to be honest with you. I was working on something totally different, completely unrelated. I was working on a fictional project at the time when he got elected. And then I dropped all of that and put it aside and started working on this instead, because I do still care about this country. And I want people to know what we're up against.
There's a lot to learn, for sure. And I'm glad you've made this film. What's the next project? What are you working on now?
You know, this was so... this was a difficult project to make and very depressing and disheartening. So I think the next thing I'm going to do is going to be a fantasy, a movie that's totally fictional, has nothing to do with politics or Trump or religion, something that kids and parents can watch together.
Certainly sounds like a worthwhile project. In fact, that reminds me, speaking of making movies, I had a guest on the show a couple of months ago, Andy Herndon, who's doing another film documentary called The Exvangelicals. And I mean, that would be an interesting connection. Yeah, because a lot of the same things you're mentioning are what he's interested in, talking to people who have come out of evangelicalism so people can get involved with the Exvangelicals project as well if they're interested in doing some more research and investigation on the effects of leaving church. Now, as far as your movie, though, Chris, how can people find it? I think I heard you say it's on Amazon as well as on iTunes, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Right now it's available on Amazon Video and also iTunes. So especially for listeners in Great Britain and Europe, it is available over there now on both of those platforms, as well as here in America.
Yeah, I saw it on Amazon. I was going to look on iTunes as well, but is it going to be on Netflix at any point, or is it like one of those things where if it's on Amazon, it can't be on Netflix? Is that sort of how it works?
I was in touch with Netflix for a while. They're actually so inundated with documentaries right now that they kind of put a cap on that. So Amazon and iTunes is where you have to go, at least at the time being. In the future, it might be on PBS, but for now, it's just those two platforms.
Well, it's definitely accessible. And that's the other question I was going to ask you, was how can people get a hold of you if they want to discuss more about your film and any other projects that you're doing? What's the best way for people to reach you?
I'm on Twitter at Maloney's Movies. And then there's a website in GodWeTrumpFilm.com. And you can contact me through that also.
So people can get a hold of you on a couple of ways through social media. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's good to bounce things off of, like you say, other people who have kind of had similar journeys. And I think this Trump vote and continued support for him, we don't know where all it's going to lead, do we? But I'm fascinated, like you, to see where in the next 10 or 15, 20 years, where does the evangelical church end up? I can't see them being in a very good place because of their decisions.
Yeah, I think time's up for them. I think it's one of those institutions that's done enough damage, and it's not going to stand on its two legs for very long. So I think it's going to topple over in the next few years, and I look forward to that.
And hopefully whatever replaces it or is more of a grassroots or, as you say, something that's a lot more authentic in terms of spirituality. Certainly people are discovering that now. This is something I'm exploring, yep, the spirituality piece of it, because I've realized that because of all the toxicity in my past out of evangelicalism, I've kind of walled that whole piece off. But I'm realizing, no, this is actually a pretty important component of holistic life. So there's a lot to explore out there that we were warned against. You know, the church told us, no, you can't explore Eastern mysticism and Buddhism. That's of the devil. So hopefully there's a lot of stuff out there that hopefully people will start to connect with and maybe find some healing from the trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, whatever it is that keeps you from being an asshole is that should be your spirituality. Whatever helps you get there.
If you ever start a church, maybe that should be your church's mission and vision statement. You could have a big banner. Don't be an asshole.
That's, yeah.
And you know what? I might go to that church if that was your mission statement up on the wall, just painted in big letters. I think I could be a part of that. Yeah, I could. I'll preach a sermon.
It doesn't be any simpler than that for me. I have two kids, and what we always tell them is the most important thing is to be kind. So whatever you believe that helps you to be kind, we're in support of that.
And you don't have to attach all the religious dogma to it, do you? Because that was the problem, is we were told to be kind, but it was only to be kind to other people so that we could build relationships with them for the purpose of evangelizing them. There's always these hidden agendas, and you got to overthink everything. So why does it have to be so you know, all the dogma attached to it. It's just unbelievable how it affects every level of our lives and our psyches, really. It's done a lot of damage to a lot of people.
Yep.
I'm recovering from it, which sounds like you are too. Well, listen, Chris, I don't want to keep you too long. I've had a great time. I've loved meeting up with you. I'm glad we connected. We connected on Twitter, actually. So obviously mm-hmm. there's a good way to get a hold of you, Chris, on Twitter that have questions about your film or whatever other projects you're working on.
Yeah, and actually, I'm doing something now where if there are any churches that are interested in hosting a screening of the film, I'm making that available for free. So anybody who is part of a church now or who leads a church or whatever, if they get in touch with me, we can set something up for free just because I want people to be able to see it.
That would be an interesting discussion for sure. I'm sure, as you say, the classic fundamentalist churches might not show it, but I think they should. It absolutely should be seen in churches. Why not? You know, if they really want to talk about what's going on, then it's an important subject to get into. Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Chris, I don't want to keep you. As I say, thank you so much for being on Mindshift Podcast. I've had an absolutely wonderful time getting to know you and bouncing ideas off you. I've had a great time. I hope you have too.
Yeah, same here, man. Really, really good to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks again, Chris. Well, I don't know what side of the political or religious divide you find yourself on, but I think Chris's warning is a prescient one. Even if you're not in any way associated with evangelicalism, you need to know what the evangelical church in America is doing. They have an incredible connection with the party in power right now in America. In fact, just on the 14th of November, if you look up the hashtag Faith Briefing on Twitter, you'll discover a whole bunch of thread and thousands of tweets where we had CCM, Christian Contemporary Music artists, descending upon the White House, singing, praying, worshiping God, and just reading through some of the tweets. Man, these evangelicals are absolutely ecstatic that they get the opportunity to go to the White House and do this in a now Christian nation no longer apparently being persecuted like I was talking about in the introduction. And this is why they are so happy to support Donald Trump right now. Therefore, from their point of view, this is why they would say things like, Donald Trump is God's man. God has chosen him for this moment. And the legislation that's already been passed, appointments that have been made in terms of Supreme Court justices, and laws that are on the books or proposed to be on the books, being pushed and promoted by evangelicals, by this right-wing coalitions, this is happening. This is what's going on. And this is in large part why so many evangelicals are ecstatic and overjoyed, not only that Donald Trump became president in the first place, but that all this legislation and all these appointments have already happened, or they think they're hopefully going to happen. So you're going to be affected by it no matter what side of the aisle you stand on. This is what's going on. So I hope it's helped to make you aware a little bit of the backstory and the current situation, what's going on in America today. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Chris Maloney. Go out and see his film, In God We Trump. I think you'll find that it's an eye-opening piece of work. Once again, I've been your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. You can always send me your thoughts and comments on Twitter at MindShift2018. I look forward to hearing what you think about this episode. So thanks for joining me and Chris Maloney on this special edition of MindShift Podcast.